Welcome to the Living with Alzheimer's podcast. On this show, we share Ginger's journey and speak with subject matter experts about a variety of dementia-related topics. Ginger, a former English teacher and librarian, was diagnosed with Alzheimer's in 2019. This diagnosis has changed her world and has given her a unique perspective on life and living. I'm Christoph, Ginger's son and full-time caregiver. I've created this podcast as a way to share the best practices I'm learning about caring for a person with dementia. Along the way, we'll document my mother's journey through her unique storytelling. You can subscribe to the Living with Alzheimer's podcast and find all the resources we discuss at lwalz.com. In this episode of Living with Alzheimer's, I interview Max Sherman, author of Releasing the Butterfly, A Love Affair in Four Acts. The book shares many insights about caring for someone with Alzheimer's while telling the story of Max and his wife Jean Alice, who met as teenagers in the 1950s while volunteering at a jail. Max tells the story of how he and Jeannie created a partnership that enabled Max to become a lawyer, state senator, and university president, while Jeannie earned her doctorate to become a professor of music. The story continues as he tells how their shared love of literature, theater, film, and music became a critical connection after Jeannie was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. In our conversation, Max shares many of the insights he's gained as a caregiver and thoughts on how to maintain a connection, even while grieving the losses of the fading abilities of a spouse living with Alzheimer's. And Max wanted to be certain to share that, in honor of Jeannie, all proceeds from the book go to the Austin Presbyterian Theological Seminary's program in sacred music. Well, welcome to the Living with Alzheimer's podcast, Max. I want to thank you for being a guest. In your book, you seem very humble despite all of your hard work and success, evolving from this hard scrabble single parent household to becoming a lawyer, a state senator, a university president. And there are other titles that you didn't mention in your book, but you know, you've traveled the world, you've rubbed elbows with foreign dignitaries and royalty. Way outside of my realm of experience, many of the things that you've done in your life. So how do you introduce yourself to people given such a rich personal history?
Well, as you put your finger on it, my life is, and my wife's both, would be lives that have been lived by accident. One thing accidentally led to another and one to another. And so I've always kind of avoided the long introductions, and we actually are both very active Presbyterians, and we have gravestones that are already erected, and all they have on them is whenever our date of passing, and I'm on there listed as a lawyer by training, a politician by practice, and an academic by accident, and that kind of all different pieces of my background fit into those categories. And, but as I say, so that's probably I put it on there long before we met. So it was one thing I had to find a way to shorten who I was.
Yeah. Well, again, I really appreciate you taking time to, spend time talking to me about your book and some of your life and what that has been. So, talking about the book, Releasing the Butterfly, A Love Affair in Four Acts. You know, the first thing that hit me is it's great storytelling. I do a lot of reading, and there are some books that I have slogged through, and because it's required or because I really do want the information in there, but the reading is not easy. And I had intended on doing some skimming to prep for our conversation so that I would know what your story was. And I couldn't put it down. I cover to cover, I read every word you wrote, Max. So I was really sucked into the story that you tell. It's quite compelling. And not just your life and your wife, Jean Alice, and all of the things that you did, because that's amazing, but also just because of the number of interactions that you talk about as a couple learning how to, you know, be what you actually label as a partnership. And, you know, you call it the partnership. And I felt like there were some really great lessons just in how to live in there, just, you know, on top of all of the adventure and, you know, those kinds of things. So, you know, at the small level, at the beginning level, you know, you could describe the book as a boy and girl of humble means, meeting and falling in love, working hard to accomplish great things, and then being crushed by this thief named Alzheimer's. But you don't tell that story of being crushed, changed, maybe, you know, challenged, certainly, but not crushed. So how do you sum up the book?
Well, I probably, in order to do it, I probably ought to tell you how it happened, is that after the Alzheimer's hit, and it, we had a lead-up period of several months, small forgetfulness, and it evolved. And when it hit, I actually started writing when I was on hospice. And my life had ended, our lives had ended, and it was fiction. I was just dreaming. Mm-hmm. And someone asked me a question. I thought, well, I can't talk about Jeannie and Max. I just can't do that. And so I dreamed, thought, I don't know, epiphany, I don't know what you call it. But all of a sudden I saw a stage floating over my head. And I remembered in high school seeing him actually playing in the little play by Thornton Wilder called Our Town. Mm-hmm. And the two main characters were Emily and George. So what I really started out doing was writing a play. And it, I started by writing scene by scene at 3 o'clock in the morning when I would wake up in agony. And it was in George and Emily. And in that play, the stage manager is very important to it. He tells the story. So when I would wake up, I was the patient. And I was also my own psychiatrist. I was getting therapy, and I was playing both roles.
Okay.
And so each night I would talk to myself, and then I would put it into a scene in the play. And then one play, one scene, it morphed into a three-act play, and then it morphed into a five-act play, and things just could be happening. And people kept asking me, how am I dealing with it? Or what are you dealing? What's it going? How do you do? Can you see your wife? On and on. And so a lot of friends and family were aware that I was screwed up, I guess you would say. Mm-hmm. And I was writing. And so finally it ended up in the five-act play. And then the next iteration was it really ought to be a story. And it's not my story. It's Jean Alice's story. And so I actually wrote a whole sequence all in her voice, in the woman's voice. And a friend of mine said, you know, that's impossible. You have to be very talented to do something in one voice. And it's probably going to at least have to be two voices. So anyway, the iteration continued. And over a long period of time, it evolved. And it came up with the book. And it really is, it's a miracle. It's a process. I mean, I do know how to write. I like to write. I've written the book about Barbara Jordan's because she was my good friend way back. But it's just a narrative. So I never had thought of telling a story, and especially not about my life. And then another friend finally said, you know, you're going to have to make it into a memoir so that you really can tell your stories. And so friend by friend, accident by accident, over a period of time, it evolved. And then one thing that haunts me is that Alzheimer's is still, at this moment, a stigma. No one wants to talk about it.
That is the truth.
Well, she just forgets, or he just forgets. He just made a mistake. And then after Jean Alice's tsunami hit and we were kind of exploded, almost everyone then wanted to talk to me about it. But up until that time, people that we'd been talking with 2 or 3 years, no one ever wanted, never came up.
Right.
And so I think somewhere we're going to have to avoid the stigma of it and get it out in the open, as you're doing in your podcast, and begin to talk about it. And then that helps researchers and other people to do things that they need to do.
I concur, Max. I feel like we don't talk about Alzheimer's enough. And my experience is a little similar in that when I was first informed that my mom had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, I didn't know anything. And I started talking to the people, you know, around me. And that was when I heard stories that I had never heard before of their grandparents or, you know, a good friend or something like that who, you know, they had been dealing with Alzheimer's, but hadn't shared it. And, you know, I didn't know anything about it. They didn't, you know, really share their knowledge about it. So when I started as a caregiver, I was starting from scratch. And I feel like as a society, if we can talk more about the issues that we face, all of us are more prepared if we have to deal with such a thing. And unfortunately, the stats are not good. And, you know, in the book, in fact, you mentioned a lot of the statistics for dementia and Alzheimer's, and it's not pretty. So more than 5 million Americans have Alzheimer's, and that frequency is increasing. 1 in 3 seniors will die of Alzheimer's or some other form of dementia. Almost 2/3 of the people with Alzheimer's are women, and more than 70% of the Alzheimer's caregivers are women. And for me, the most stunning is of the top 10 causes of death in America, Alzheimer's is the only one that can't currently be slowed or cured, which was a stat that I hadn't heard before, put that way. That was new information. And just, it floors me. And so we talk about the fact that we're not discussing this, but also I just wonder, as a statesman, you know, former senator, what do you think the United States should be doing about this thief? I'll just call Alzheimer's a thief.
Well, I think it almost starts, Christoph, I think it almost starts much, much earlier. And I, for one, and I'm not sure, but it's a little political statement, but I really think that if we had some kind of a system that every human being, everyone at least in this country, where we have some control over it, could have good health care. And your mother probably had good health care. My wife had good health care. So yeah, it was not the absence of health care. But for the pandemic of it, I think that if you really gave everybody the chance to live the most healthful life they could live, and then I think many of the great successes we've had, going to the moon and the astronauts,
right,
have had some kind of funding at the federal level where we all put something in the pot. And there have been, I think, over 300 research projects that have been out there, and they still haven't quite figured out how Alzheimer's came about. Mm-hmm. I moderated a panel several years ago with Bill and Judith Moyers and their son, Cope, dealing with the subject of addiction. Mm-hmm. And Judith Moyers told a poignant story to me, and it's all transcribed. But she said, you know, breast cancer used to be like this. No one talked about breast cancer. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, Betty Ford, President Ford's wife, came out and said she had breast cancer.
Yep.
And so all of a sudden, it was on the agenda and people started talking about it. I have 6 granddaughters, no grandsons, all granddaughters.
Okay.
They all have participated in fundraisers for breast cancer. And I think we're going to have to get to the point that Alzheimer's is equally as prevalent, and people like you and me and others can get involved and help do something. So it's probably going to be about a several level thing, but healthcare probably is critical. I think they think these plaques build up. How do you continue to do something about that?
Right.
And in the reading I've done, one of the scary things to me, my wife is brilliant. She's a professor. She's an organist. She's a piano player. She ran a conference center and took people all over the world. And we supported each other half and half all through our lives, and we still do. She's still living, and we still do that even today. And we might talk about that in a minute. But one of the scary things is that people that do have a lot of intellectual ability, there's maybe more susceptible in ways. So somewhere it's how you use the mind. And I think that's an experiment that's going to have to be run, and it's going to take great researchers, and you'll have failure after failure. But at some point, they're going to come up with something that helps to do that. Cancer is now getting a lot of treatments that it did never get before because it was out in the open.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my mom also, probably the most titled person from an educational standpoint in our family, you know, bachelor's, master's, and specialist degree, did many things in the community with women's groups and also in education. And she was a librarian for, a number of years. And so just a real go-getter, extremely intelligent, very logical. And to see that slip away and now be almost not present is devastating. You know, that all of that investment in developing logic and intelligence is washed away by, you know, this disease that we don't really understand, as you say, with something going on with plaques in the brain and, you know, what else is actually going on and how can we prevent it. So I like your approach, though, just some healthcare for all, so that we have a basis to catch it earlier and, help people as early as possible with slowing down if they are showing symptoms. I know that new treatments are coming to the market now that may help future, people as they're diagnosed with the disease. Yep. So, yeah. So based on your, let me go back. You detail many of Jean Alice's skills and how they've been gradually stolen from her in the book. I was feeling a lot of empathy for what you described, different circumstance, but to watch my mom's abilities fading and to hear your descriptions of Jeannie's abilities fading, I have admitted on the podcast before that I often start with frustration. When there's that change, the rug pulled out from under your feet, the new loss that you didn't really expect or see coming, or maybe you saw coming but didn't, we're hoping it would not come now, I tend to be frustrated first, right, and upset. And I have to calm myself down, remind myself, give myself a talking to come back to a place of patience and grace. And I felt like in your descriptions of how you worked with Jean Alice, that you led more with the grace. And you know, I'm sure there was frustration in there. But how did you manage to navigate away from reactions of anger and frustration so as not to damage your connection with Jeannie? And as I said in my notes, I'm asking for a friend.
Sure. Well, to me, the great wake-up call in the book, I think it's chapter 46. It's only about three or four pages. Very short.
Can I pause right there? Because chapter 46 sounds daunting. The book is an easy read because your chapters are also small. So thank you for small chapters, bite-sized thoughts. You know, I really enjoyed that. So apologies for somebody's going to think this is a 300-page tome that they're going to have to slog through. But no, you just break it into very digestible parts. So apologies.
The reason that's such a wake-up call for me is Jean Alice and I, I say she's a great musician. She does everything beautifully. She still does. And we she was doing a Pilates group. I had to do the driving. And we got in our apartment here, and we'd sold our home, and we moved here so we had more convenient. And we went down to the ground floor, and she was excited. I said, "Well, let's hurry. You don't want to be late." Oh, she said, they won't start without me. And, mm-hmm. and we get down to the ground floor in the elevator, and she just backs over into the back of the elevator and is looking at me just in a horrified look and says, "I'm not going to that place again." Well, she's been going for the last 8 or 10 years. And I realized by that time she didn't know where that place was. She didn't know where mm-hmm. we were going. And so we have this little tit for tat, but on your point about your own situation, for anyone who reads it, it's the first time that it really came to me how much I was hurting and grieving mm-hmm. as a caregiver. I mean, I put it off. I know how to do that. You know, you keep pushing.
Right.
And I just exploded. And I said, "Don't ever say that again. Uh-huh. Don't ever say that again. We're going to keep living. We're going to keep working puzzles. We're going to keep doing music. We're going to keep dancing. We're going to do all those things that we've been doing, watching movies and talking about them and discussing books." And then I realized that that was my wake-up moment, mm-hmm. that all of a sudden I had to acknowledge that it hurts. It hurts like hell. And you've got to acknowledge it. Then how do you live with that and move on? And the other part in that same little three pages that was haunting to me is that I also realized that I had taken over her life. I was making all the decisions.
Right.
I was choosing her clothes. And I was laying out the food. I was doing all the preparation. I did all the driving. I picked the shows we watched. I picked the articles we discussed. And I said, I believe I was stealing Jeannie from Jeannie. I was doing it nibble by nibble. And I realized that it's so subtle. It is so subtle, Christoph, that I realized what I should be doing is say, "Jeannie, would you like chocolate or vanilla ice cream?" Mm-hmm. "Oh, you decide. Would you like to watch a movie or maybe a mystery or a comedy?" "Oh, you decide." But the most important thing is, and I said, I think the headline is not just important. She had to be asked. She wanted to be asked.
Right.
She wanted to maintain her autonomy. And that's so subtle. You don't really know how it works, what it is. But all of a sudden I said, you know, just the same thing we're doing, just turn it over and do it another way. And instead of doing one thing, you know, sometimes just you don't have to say anything if you just hold a hand. As we're together now, day in and day out, every morning and afternoon, I put my hand on her knee, hold her foot, and touches a powerful, powerful healing component. And you don't even have to say any words. Mm-hmm. Just have hold the hand. It's a kind of a new kind of hugging. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, I'm learning day by day how we can do that.
Yeah, I've definitely done a lot more hand-holding with my mom, you know, in the past year, which started just because of, you know, her being confused even mid-trip to a particular room or something like that. It just became easier to just walk with her, you know. Kind of like in the store, instead of saying it's down in aisle 3, you actually take them to aisle 3, you know. Mm-hmm. And so it did you know, change the dynamic between us, you know, and help slow me down. Because I think the other thing for me was I was often in a hurry, and it was just easier to make decisions for her. And so what you speak of is to bring that person back into the decision-making process, even if they wave it off and say, "It's okay, you decide," you know.
You mentioned something, interject if I might, because you've lived through it and I did. One of the things that many caregivers in the future may not have to struggle with was the COVID epidemic, mm-hmm. because that really threw a monkey wrench into our lives. Up until that time, she was walking, and one time she loves music. Music is a powerful tool also. You don't want to overlook music as right. you deal with people going through, because it reaches into the heart in a way that you will never understand. But she loves music. And we used to, even in the early stages, we'd play something. She has all these CDs, and she always has music playing. And in the early days, I would say, let's dance. So we would get up and do a little dancing. Well, COVID comes along and she can't get up for a long time. And so now she no longer walks. So it's progressed. But I think the tipping point on that one was a mess that everybody in the whole nation and the world right. was living with. Right. But it shifted gears. So I hope your listeners and people who follow you will, I hope that they don't have to go through that kind of a many, many, many months of
Separation
and disaster, really.
Right. Yeah, you described that because you were in assisted living already when the pandemic came, and assisted living facilities were really having a hard time with their responsibility for their populations. And so my dad was still alive during the pandemic, and we had just weeks before all the shutdowns started, we wow. got my parents moved into assisted living, and then there they were. Everything just kind of shut down, and they were isolated, and we couldn't really even visit, and you know, that kind of thing. And so that was, an extra layer of challenge, but just so isolating. And I feel like this disease is isolating anyway, you know, as the world shrinks for the individual, you know, that, and honestly, as people around, it can be uncomfortable for the people around you. And so I think there were definitely people who drew back, and, you know, were less involved, because they didn't really know how to respond, to this changing individual who's being changed by a disease, you know. And that goes back to this, you know, the statement that you said at the start, with there's still a lot of stigma around Alzheimer's and our conversations about it. So you write about all of the adaptation that you had to do of the new realities, but you really had a don't give up attitude. And it stood out to me that you continued to find potential for connecting with Jeannie even as her capabilities failed and faded. So what did you really do to stay, you know, on top of that, to find new ways to connect?
Yeah, I think the building blocks for connecting, even at this stage, because Jeannie has now been into the moved to real Alzheimer's about 9 years now. So we've been going mm-hmm. through this quite a long time.
Right.
And as you hear by talking to you, I have a kind of a high raspy voice, but I learned something just yesterday. I hadn't thought about it to your question, but we were in an elevator, and all of a sudden when your sound is there, she was hearing my voice, and boy, she popped up and looked over at, because the sound was right there. And we probably are not aware that many times they're not hearing everything the way that we do, because it was a wake-up call to me. But one of the things I found is if I've got my hand on her knee and I'll say some song, I'll say zippity-doo-dah, zippity-a, I'll sing an old church song.
Yep.
You know, let us gather at the river, and I'll sing her. And if I can't forget the words, I just hum it out.
Right.
And so music is still there. And then when I was trying to get her to convince that I should marry her and we would become equal partners in our life, I recited a lot of poetry. Mm-hmm. And the first one I did was one of, you know, Shakespeare's poems, you know, that about love. Let me not to the marriage of true minds admit impediments. Love is not love which alters when an alteration finds, but stretches out to the edge of doom. But and I'll say that poem, and boy, she perks up because I've been singing it to her since she was 15 years old, mm-hmm. and the poetry comes back. And so storytelling, and then I'll, you know, you kind of, I think a danger that a lot of us face is, you know, I think it's maybe you may eventually ask me about this, but I think it's the difference in my being a spouse and
right.
you know, you're being a child,
right.
is that we're together all the time. And, but I think people that are coming and going will come and say, oh, you remember when we did this? Well, she doesn't remember. And so I think you learn not to put her on the spot. Mm-hmm. You know, you tell it about it. And it's one of the stories that's haunting to me in the book. It's a friend of mine. We were good friends, but not close friends. And when he heard that I was in the hospital with a shattered femur, mm-hmm. when this all exploded, he wanted to come and see. So the first two or three visits, and I was there for a few weeks, first two or three visits, we were talking about how am I doing, my healing. And then we got around to really why he was coming. His mother had Alzheimer's. And later he asked me, and he told about her taking off all of her clothes, going to walk out into the rain, and they were fixing the door so they couldn't get out. But the wake-up call to me from him, and I learned it from him, I give him credit, is that one day he was sitting in the back seat, and he's a judge. He was a judge, a very good lawyer. His father was driving, and mother was in the front seat. And she says, well, we can't go without Daddy. And the father, like most of us, type A people, says, you know, your father's been dead for 30 years.
Right.
And so, well, we cannot go without Daddy. We must have Daddy to go. And my friend sitting in the back seat, the judge, all of a sudden it dawns on him. He said, Mama, I just talked to Papa, and he doesn't want to go. Problem solved. It just
right.
shifted gears just that little bit. And so I learned that little white lies are just okay.
Yep.
And in the early days when Jeannie was alone and I'm alone, and I was advised not to see her, to let her know that she had to feel comfortable where she was, over and over I would call every morning at 10 and every evening at 6. You got to come and get me. I can get my clothes. I need to be with you. But, you know, I stayed away. And you just begin to realize, I said, well, you know, I've got to go to the doctor tomorrow, so I'll come after I see the doctor.
Yep.
A little white lie, but I learned that. And then I have a friend, this didn't end up in the book, but a friend who would every week would take her husband's clothes home and iron them and clean them, bring them back. And one day she brought them all back in, and he says, I'm not wearing those clothes anymore. I'm just not going to wear them. She can't do, well, she's been wearing them. And she was devastated. And she, so all of a sudden she just went out in the hall, waited for 3 or 4 or 5 minutes, brought the same clothes in. Oh, I'm glad you came with my clothes. I'm glad they're here, you know.
Right.
So you don't want to take the last word is the last word.
Right.
It may be that there's something you can build on and learn to adjust to the temperament. And, you know, we were standing one time at a place in Montana when we were in early stages, and we saw an osprey outside. We dashed out to watch it. And then she looks over and says, what are you? You're not my husband. Why are you doing here? And all of a sudden I thought, did you see the bird up there? Shifted again. And she was back with me. Shift, shift, shift. And you don't know why or how, except begin to let go and go with the flow, I guess, is the best thing
right.
I could come up with.
Right. Yeah, you're right. I mean, I have the ongoing battle with my mom is to drink enough water for whatever reason. It's really common for people to just say, I don't want to drink water. And my mom is definitely on that boat. You know, she's like, it's an issue. And, you know, if she gets dehydrated, then that leads to other problems. So it's important for her to get her water in. And I, you know, would initially, when I was her caregiver, Mom, you got to drink this water. No, Mom, you have to drink this water. And it became this battle. And of course she would win the battle just by refusing to drink. And I'm left frustrated. And I finally figured out, you know, if I just ask her again, you know, no big deal. Okay, Mom. No big deal. And come back like you say, in 2-3 minutes and ask again, I would get sometimes a favorable response just by asking again and not getting all upset about it. So, yeah, it really is about approach. But those are the hard things to find, and to have the patience to look for those things, to be sensitive enough to see those things. I think that's really the key, and your book is full of the kinds of adjustments that you make, the shift, as you say, in order to keep that working.
Let me jump in on that one, because we have a lot of people that will see us here in this, where we are, and they know Jenny's situation, and if when you're around, if you look for the little things. If she's in a wheelchair now because she's not walking because of COVID, if she has her head over here, she may be taking a nap or really sleeping. If she has her head straight down, she's hearing every word that you're saying.
Okay.
And that little signal is that's just that little bit of a different one. But if I'm talking to her and I'm holding her foot and I say, could I throw you a kiss? Well, we've learned that just chomping it is a return kiss.
Okay.
And then the other one is, of course, she's a pianist and organist. She has the ability to take her big toe, and actually I couldn't do it, but she takes that bit. And I say, can I get a kiss? And that big toe comes up.
Okay.
So there are those little signals that are entirely unscripted.
Right.
You won't ever, and they wouldn't be the same for your mom as they are for hers. But
right.
If you begin to realize the little signals that are there. And then one other story, which I do think is in the book, when we first moved in, she was first down in memory care. There were three women that always had their heads down. I never once ever saw them without their heads down in a wheelchair. I didn't know them, but we had a little Shih Tzu dog, and the organist in our church asked Jeannie when she was still playing the piano with him and all, and if she would go down to memory care or the activity room and play the piano with him. So I have this little dog, and I'm not sure I should have him there, and especially to go out in the other crowd with 30 or 40 other people. Mm-hmm. And so I take her and put her in my lap, and they're playing the piano and people sitting here. The woman, one of the three women sitting next to me, never, ever in my life did I see her raise her head. And she had it always down, looked like she was not with us. And I holding that little dog in my hand, it spooks me to this day. She starts petting it. Mm-hmm. She pets the dog. How did she know he was there? I have no idea. But she's petting the dog. Hmm. The dog did something that no human being could do.
And I
don't understand it, but yeah. I've witnessed it. I cry about it right now.
Right. Yeah. And that sadness, Max, that's the grief, right?
And
it's also part of the joy, those moments when you do connect.
Yeah. Well, even my getting into tears as I talk to you, I'm pretty good not to do that, but all of a sudden some unexpected thing will happen and it just explodes, you know. Right. So, you know, deep down inside, there's still a lot of that grief going on.
Right.
So you probably just need to be honest that's there and acknowledge it.
I keep thinking I'm done grieving and then realize, no, I'm not. And, you know, it's like, okay, I've gotten over the fact that I'm losing my mom. And you know, there will be a new loss, and then I will feel the grief again. It's a long process, and it just doesn't really end.
Yeah. Could I jump in on one more? Because
yeah.
As I've been around, you're fortunate. You're there with your mom. I'm with my wife. There are people that don't have much of a family. In fact, they may not have any family. And there have been two instances of people that I only met because of memory care that I heard they were an extremist, and two people that I'm not even sure their names now, but I went down and just held their hands, and they would nod their head and be glad that someone And I mentioned it earlier, I don't know that we really know the value of a touch.
Right.
And I just held a hand and actually was holding one of the lady's hands. And it's almost, she said, now I'm happy, gave up her life. And she had no family.
You know, I've often wondered if the person can't remember the thing, is there value in doing the thing? And I think the answer is yes, there is value. In that moment, that connection is made, and there is a responsiveness, especially when there's a responsiveness that you can tell. You know, it is worth the effort to try and make that connection. Those lines, you highlight how you made a point of honoring the individual for, you know, who Jeannie was, even as the Alzheimer's progressed. And, you know, for Jeannie, that was, you know, the spokesperson and later the love of art and creative expression, you know, through it all, as you said, music. For my mom, that has really been about social interaction. She's a social butterfly. And, you know, to keep her in situations, I try and set up, without tiring her out, I try and set up the ways that she likes to interact with people. And she will greet someone at the door who has never been there before as if they're a long-lost friend. You know, in that moment, it's a big joy for her just because that's what she loves, you know, is to interact with people. So how would you advise caregivers on ways to honor their loved ones as the individuals, even as their abilities are fading?
You know, I think it's probably a little bit of a catharsis for all of us, in that we kind of sometimes live on the surface, and we do, and we come and we go, and we have meals together, and we don't often really have to think back about some of those treasured moments. Maybe it might be when you're out hiking, or you may have been a time you talked about a bird. What was it about that bird? Is it color? And so you begin to dig deeper into experiences that you probably wouldn't have if you weren't having to deal with this issue of Alzheimer's and trying to communicate. So you really kind of reflect on your lives, and you remember those things. And then all of a sudden, out of that, you realize maybe there's a particular song that captures it. You know, a chocolate ice cream that you've forgotten. It's not just having ice cream, but it was chocolate ice cream. Mm-hmm. And so all of a sudden, you really become a little more intentional about looking into the soul. It's a little bit of a spiritual, religious experience. And I'm not sure what it is, but I just think you've got to go beyond the surface, because I think we all come and go. We get busy lives. We have jobs. We have to go to work. We get up and we move. And another question that you suggested we might have to talk about was the difference in the spouse's situation and the family. And that leads to that one, because I think in your case, you're a child of your mom and your dad, and you've been there. But the spouse, and we're getting ready to be married 63 years, and we're still married. Well, one of the things that you realize is that every meal was a meal together. You realize that every night you slept together. Mm-hmm. You realize when you watched the show, you were together. So all of a sudden, every event of life is a recollection that it's not like it used to be. And that adds to the possible grieving and internalizing. And then somewhere you've got to be able to work through to realize that it's not going to be that way again. How do I recapture the moment? How do I watch a movie? We've always watched foreign movies. We started, but our first date was to see a foreign movie. And so I find myself not looking, when I'm alone, to watching some movie from Spain or from Finland or from Mexico, from Italy, and from Greece. And all of a sudden I find that I can really almost experience as if we were doing it together. But I had to work, had to make that transition. It's the same thing, but I realized that it was not going to be with her sitting there holding my hand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had taken my mom to a center where they do daycare, but they also provide opportunity for people with dementia to interact with the kids. So it's meant, it's a campus meant to, you know, expose the kids to, you know, typically elderly, you know, individuals who are suffering with some form of dementia. But it's also a way for those, you know, people with dementia to interact with kids, which typically, like my mom, is just nutsy. If she sees, you know, a kid in the store, she really wants to interact. It always brings a smile to her face. But behind the scenes, the other thing that was going on is they were, they had a cafe specifically for the spouses of the people suffering with dementia so that they could get together and share and commiserate and just relax with somebody else who actually understood, you know, their situation and the struggles that they were facing as a spouse of someone with dementia. And how do I conduct myself? How do I solace myself? How do I move through this grieving? And how do I do it, you know, graciously? I really saw a lot of powerful things going on there between spouses that I'm not sure that kids who are taking care of their parents or taking care of their grandparents have that same kind of need, definitely to talk with each other. But I really felt like there was a special level of grieving for the spouses.
You know, I think it's in many of these movies I'm seeing, you see many people all sitting around in a circle sharing their stories, from people who are involved in alcoholism, from people in addiction, to people doing some kind of therapy. But one of the things you're realizing is that that sharing of experiences is therapeutic. Mm-hmm. It really helps you to realize I'm not the only one going down this road. And I think that's why the judge's visit to me was so important, because we've known each other a long time, but never knew his mother had Alzheimer's. He didn't have any people he could talk with about it. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden, I was able to be an outlet for him to talk about it. And that group of friends, of spouses, is a place where they can do that also, where you can share it and realize I'm not alone. And I think that's awfully important to do, is, you know, you beat yourself to death, but all of a sudden you say, you know, I'm not alone. Other people are going through this. And I think that's healthy.
Yeah, I agree. And it's also helpful, you know, just, again, hearing someone else's perspective and how they're approaching it. I've learned things from talking to you just now, you know, and that I'll refocus on the music and the touch, you know, those things. Obviously, the way you communicated them is impactful to someone who's listening to that, and that sharing is a powerful thing. So thank you. Again, I appreciate you sharing your experience, because it is helpful to step back and ponder what more can I do, you know, to, you know, make the quality of life as good as possible for the person I'm caring for.
You know, could I share one thing? We may have a moment left.
Yeah.
One of the big shockers to me, because I think, as you know, Texas Alzheimer's has relaunched my book and taken it out, and it's now part of their statewide program here. And but out of that, you begin to realize that there are things that go on that you have no control over. And there was a couple in Atlanta, Georgia, anonymous. I don't know who they are. Mm-hmm. They'd read the book somewhere, and one of them said to the other, you know, I wish that I had known about this and about how powerful music is. Well, they picked up the music piece, contacted a friend of theirs, and then out of the three of them, they made a very significant gift to Texas Alzheimer's in honor of me and said stimulated by the book. Don't know them, who they are, but the music had been there all the time, but this all of a sudden made them aware of it. And the other signal that to me was something, pure accident, many, many, many years ago, my wife and I were Presbyterians, but we were in Israel. And when we were there, we visited Tel Aviv University. And so I've been on the list for Tel Aviv University about all their programs, and they do some very wonderful things. And they had a program on Alzheimer's, and I couldn't quite bring it up. So I contacted a friend who contacted a friend in Israel who I don't know and never have met, and he discovered the book. And out of that, an accident, pure accident again, it ends up being reviewed by the International Journal for Alzheimer's Disease, which is a research organization. It's the major publication on Alzheimer's. It's published in Holland, but it's international. And I'm not a doctor. It's not a scientific thing, but they reviewed it in their book for the very reasons that you're doing the podcast and that I'm talking, because it was the layman's view of how you struggle with the things these scientists are working with every day.
Yeah.
And I never would have dreamed about that, but you just need to do what you're doing is sharing the experiences, and so other people can relate and build on it. Theirs won't be the same as yours or mine, but they build upon shared experiences.
Yeah. Obviously they saw the value in that. Approaching it from a clinical view is one point, but the humanity piece is the day-to-day.
If we're getting ready to leave, would you do me a favor?
Sure.
Would you give Ginger a big hug?
I will do that. Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. So, I really enjoyed so much of the book and the tenets for living that your mom and mom-in-law stated and you restated. I shortened it down for my own sake to hang on to the thought, but it's hold hands, hug, accept life and death, cherish each other. And that to me was just like it changed my perspective. It changed my attitude. It was one of slow down, appreciate, cherish, you know. And I really appreciated those thoughts that were shared from your moms and came through you in the book. So what are there any final thoughts you'd like to leave with listeners, Max?
I think you put your hand on it. We need to thank each other and hug each other and hug our moms and our wives and touch them, hold their hands. No substitute.
Yeah. Max Sherman, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate you sharing your time. And I hope that people enjoy your book as much as I did.
Christoph, thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Living with Alzheimer's. Please visit the Living with Alzheimer's website at lwalz.com, where you can subscribe to the show and find all the resources we discuss in podcast episodes. We'll see you next time on the Living with Alzheimer's podcast.